We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA. But
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere, whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this week's episode of the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
Yeah, and I'm Peter Smith, and it's good to have you with us. And well, this week we were chatting with Nick and Thomas from the Spinto Band. They took us through their four albums, and well, they broke down Oh Mandy, which was their sort of big breakout tune, especially over here, really launched them in the UK. So they told us how that song all came together back in the day. Actually, talking about Spinto Band being big in the UK, there's a nice story from Nick about a trip that he made to London in 2005, the summer of 2005. It was like a graduation present for him that he could go over the water to here. And he had a great time checking out loads of bands. And, you know, crazy world that it is. 12 months later, he was back here with his band, the Spinto Band, and they'd taken off and they're playing to sort of, fantastic crowds and were actually part of the scene here, Rich.
Yeah, they really were part of the scene, weren't they? I even thought they were an English band at first. I remember being quite surprised when I found out they were an American band. But ingrained in the scene as they were. Some great stories on this pod from Nick and Thomas. And another request, actually. So following our request on our previous podcast with Fred from Spectre, for that Max Carlisle Megamix MP3, which Jamie came through with, here's an even bigger wish from Nick.
Such a Beatles fan, being in the same room with Paul would be mind blowing. I just feel like he's such a musical dude. It'd be fun to, I mean, that's, you know, take a moonshot. You know, let's go for it.
There you go. Yeah, put it out there. See if he's listening.
Yeah. Sure, he's got another album on the horizon.
Yeah, I'm here if you need me, Paul.
Yeah, I think that one's a bit more ambitious than Fred's request on last week's podcast. Let's see if we can make it happen, listeners. See if we can get Paul McCartney in the studio with Nick. loads of Beatles love in this podcast as well. Actually, not too many spoilers, but Nick reveals a really cool sort of trick that he's come up with. And it's basically, he calls it Beatles in real time. So he listens to Beatles records 50 years on from when they came out, and he refuses to listen to their other albums in between. So he's just doing it chronologically, and he's been doing it for the last few years. And I think that's so cool, because obviously when you're born after a band's boom time, you've just got this whole collection, and you can obviously dive into little different areas of it. But to listen to it chronologically, you actually get a feeling for the development of the band.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah, really like that idea. Trying to relive that actual. I think also the best thing about it being the Beatles was how quick they were, the turnaround, how many albums they put out. So got us thinking about what band we could do that with. Have a think yourselves and see if you might want to take on that sort of challenge. Loads of other interesting stuff from Nick and Thomas as well. Something quite interesting about the Spinto Band was that they actually did loads more recording before they even started gigging. It tends to be the other way around for lots of the bands we've chatted to. They even released four albums under the band name Free Beer before they even got on the road with the Spinto Band. But once they did start touring, they really hit the ground running. They even opened for the Arts and Monkeys on their first US tour. Great story on here about them playing dice with the guys from the Arts and Monkeys. So plenty to get into. We'll spoil no more and let you listen for yourselves. So here you go. Here are Nick and Thomas from the Spinto Band on the Boys in the Band podcast. This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by Nick and Thomas from the Spinto Band. How's it going, guys?
Doing well, man. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Good stuff. Well,
We always start our podcast, guys, with what we call a sound check, which is three quick-fire questions to get us warmed up. And the first one's, where are you? So, Nick, kick us off. Whereabouts are you?
I am in my mixing studio here. So just sitting in the control room of the studio, hanging out. Just did some little bit of session importing this morning, and now need to procrastinate a little bit to before I dig in. So this is the perfect thing to to dig into here.
Yeah, cool.
How about you, Thomas? Where are you today?
I am in my living room in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and just enjoying a wonderful Friday.
Very nice. And Nick, are you in Philadelphia as well?
I'm just outside of Philadelphia in Wilmington, D.C., okay. So 30 minutes south.
Cool. And we're crossing the pond there. So we're in the evening over here in the UK. You're in the afternoon. So I don't know if you've had much music on today already, but generally, guys, what our next question in the soundcheck is all about what you're listening to at the moment. So are there any bands or artists you're particularly into?
Let's see. Well, I was listening this morning my friend made a playlist of Clientele recordings. So I was listening through that and then just digging into some Richard Hawley, Cole's Corner, actually, yeah, around lunchtime today. So that was kind of inspired by talking to some dudes in the UK. Dug back into that one. Yeah.
Cool. And how about you, Thomas?
You know, I'm so bad with this current music, but the artist Dear Nora, who is this singer-songwriter, Katie Davison, released an album called Scold's Example, maybe a couple of years ago. That's my go-to listening thing when I have put music on in the car. It's just a great, great record. So that's what I have to say.
Cool, man. Nice recommendation.
Yeah, I like that. And Nick, this one's for you. So question the sound checks. Who are you producing right now? Because you mentioned there you're in your recording studio, your producing studio, and you work with a lot of other artists now.
Yeah. I'll give a shout out to a band called Fellwalker. They just put out a record last week. That's this really beautiful set of tunes. So yeah, Fellwalker. Everybody should go check that out. It's like kind of cinematic indie rock, sort of like if Johnny Greenwood and Joanna Newsom teamed up and did some kind of really cool stuff. So yeah. It's been a pleasure to work on that record. And it just came out last week.
So you go and check it out.
Yeah, sounds like a good combo. Awesome. So we'll come back to that sort of production work a little bit later in the pod. But talking about sort of laying down recordings like that have been what it's been about for the Spinto band from the very start, from what I understand. I know from what I read, you guys recorded loads and loads of stuff before you even did your first gig, and it's quite often the other way around. Bands sort of go on the road and do gigs and record much later. So you did a bit different to a lot of other bands that we've spoken to so far. So take us back to those early days, the beginning. How did it come together for you guys? How did you form and start making music, and how did you go down that route of recording before gigging?
Yeah, that's so funny. I remember being back in that, you know, high school, late middle school, high school age. And we were doing recording, and I remember being oh my gosh, we have to play shows now. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? I don't know what to do. It's we had all these cassette tapes filled with all this stuff. It was I don't know, live shows, what's that all about? but yeah, Tom, you should kick it off, because I feel like you guys had the studio at your place kind of cooking.
Yeah. My stepdad, who's the father of Albert Burney, who is also in the Spinto band for a period of time, he's a musician and had a bunch of recording equipment that he sort of, lent to us, the stuff that he was no longer using, stuff like the four-track recorder, stuff like these mixing consoles and microphones and his instruments that he just held on to. And as kids, literal children, we were just started using it to record because we were fans of music. And we had access to recording equipment, and we just started laying down. There wasn't much thought into it. I don't think we were just recording, generating ideas, just we got a new Casio keyboard. Let's make a song with it. And there'd be weekend slumber parties where we just record, 10 songs in the weekend. And then more slumber parties kept coming over, and you know, we start, you know, Nick started staying over, and it's kind of a haze. It's all in a sort of moldy basement.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I remember it being like, it's such like a magical place, but like then going down there, it's just like this basement with moldy blankets on the wall and stuff. But like, I don't know, I'd write these songs, and that was like this dream world to come over and like go into this basement, you know. It's like, maybe I get to go over like once a month, or like then it started to be like every other weekend and even more. But it's so funny, like that. It's so great to, I don't know. It was so, like, thinking back on it in my mind, like at the time, it was like the coolest studio in the world, because I just had like a little four track, but they had like a four track with like, but they could record two things at once, and they had like a drum kit, and they had like two keyboards instead of just one. And I was like, this is heavy duty, man. This is heavy stuff. And like, there's a guy that knows how to play drums. Holy cow. And they had a multi effects, like a Zoom multi effects pedal. So it was like, holy cow. Like, you can get like all these different sounds at this at their studio. But yeah, man, it was a blast.
And what a place to learn. Place to learn about that part of the process as well, because we speak to a lot of bands on this podcast who almost go into the recording studio, you know, having been signed for their live performances, not really knowing what to do. But I guess, well, you tell us, I mean, you know, you released four albums in 98 under the banner of Free Beer, but by the time you came around to doing Nice and Nicely Done, well, you guys must have been almost experts by that time. So what did you learn that stood you in good stead for that debut album?
Well, it's funny, because I feel like, I mean, experts is like, like, I don't know. I think that's being very generous of you. Because it's like, you know, I feel like we approached recording at that time like you would approach just like, I don't even know, like playing stickball, or like playing like in the street, or like throwing catch, you know. It wasn't like we were down there like, oh, like we could ping pong these tracks. It's like, and then, but wait, what if we boosted this while we ping ponged it? It was just like amazing that it all worked, and like the cables connected anything together. It was just like a win, you know? so like, I feel like I still remember there was that moment, like going into like the real studio where it's like, oh wow, like this is how it's really done. Like, I don't know. I wish I could remember, like, yeah, it was a cool time though. I feel like there's such a crazy energy in that time of your life, and I was pretty lucky to be able to like have a little clubhouse to mess around in, that's for sure, you know. I wish that now the challenge is to sort of like bring that like naive boldness back to, you know, life as I am now, you know, like to try and forget everything I've learned from any expert, and like try and just embrace some of that weird boldness. But
No, it must have been incredible to be able to sort of experiment in the way you did, because I think of a lot of bands being, you know, taking a long time before they get to a recording studio. They're really honing their craft, and you know, as soon as you started talking about, you know, recording straight away, I was like, oh, they must have been so accomplished, like even in college. but no, you were kind of still learning as you go, and learning through the recording process.
Yeah, pretty much. I think so. It's like, I remember like the other guys in the band too, and were like super big fans of that band Ween, and they were just like making the most gonzo weird sounding like home recording. So it's sort of like, you know, that sort of mentality of just like, oh cool, like we have this crazy sounding thing, and it's just like 45 seconds of this weird song, but hey, so like there's this other thing that has that same thing with this super sped up vocal, so this is what recording is.
Yeah, so were there other bands like that we all sort of inspiration and motivation at the time? Who were you sort of listening to, and how did you, as a band, did you have certain artists that you bonded over that filtered into what you were setting out to record?
Yeah, what do you say, Tom?
Yeah, it's, I mean, Ween was one of those bands that was, they were kind of inspirational in the fact that like they were they had like music videos on MTV, but they were like obviously like lo-fi like dudes recording on four tracks, and that was really cool. I think bands that we all like, because there's a lot of us in the band, I think the Flaming Lips were like a big influence in the early days. I know like Nick and I bonded over like Beck who also did a lot of like funky home recording stuff and integrated it into his music. So stuff like that was pretty inspiring, I would say, that I remember being on our radar back when we were little kids.
Yeah, Flaming Lips was big. Pavement was big back then. Yep. Sort of like that sort of Built to Spill indie rock, Pavement. The Residents were getting some spins in the car trips, oh, yeah. You know. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Cool.
And so just trying to gauge sort of age there, were you going to see these bands as well? Were you sort of inspired by live shows by these sort of bands?
Yeah. I feel like inspired more so by the recordings, but it was definitely like around that age where we started going to see shows. And like one of my most favorite memories is the Flaming Lips did this tour called the Boombox Experiments, where they brought these 40 boomboxes on tour, and then it sort of be this each one would have a tape in it, and then they'd call audience members up to play like the boombox, and Wayne and Steven would orchestrate the volume levels of these different tapes for the different members on stage. And I remember seeing that, and I got to be one of the boombox operators, and I was just like losing my mind at the time. That's so great. But yeah, you know, that was sort of like early high school times. I feel like Tom was always seeing more shows. It was always like, man, that's so cool. He got to go to like the Horde tour or something. Like, I don't know. Like, I feel like you guys are always seeing way more shows.
Yeah, I think we went to the Horde tour, which I don't know. I don't think the Horde tour went over to the UK, but it was like, I feel like jam band adjacent, but we only went to see Ween, and it was like, they played for like 30 minutes and yeah. Yeah. But yeah, we saw Pavement live like back then. But I agree with
Beck,
Nick.
I remember seeing Beck with you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of good shows back then. And it was funny too. Like I remember going to college, and I was just talking about bands and like all these bands I see. And like some of my friends, I remember specifically about Pavement. My friends like, oh my gosh, you actually got to see Pavement that before they broke up. That's incredible. And they're like so jealous they didn't get to see. And then I remember like my mom like took me to that show and like had a ticket and was just like reading in the back of the venue. You know, like she just bring a book. It's like, wow, that's so funny. There's like some kid just crying in his bedroom, like, oh, I didn't get to see Pavement. It's like my mom's like reading a Jane Austen book or something in the back of the club.
Awesome.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we take the story on then, guys, so you're obviously learning the trade, being inspired by, say, recordings and the live music you're watching. So tell us then about this process, about how you then, well, take it onto the stage. Take it to live shows yourself, because I guess, was that a daunting thing when you started playing live for the first time together, given that you'd sort of, I guess it'd been quite a internal thing between yourselves, quite a sort of exclusive thing that you shared, and then to go and take it out to other people. How was that?
Yeah, that was a situation where, like Nick was sort of alluding to, it's like we had so much material just that we had been recording, and that when it came down to actually playing live, like none of those things were recorded live to the extent that you think, like, oh, it's a bunch of us in a room like all playing together. They were just like recorded track at a time. So it sort of came to moments of just like, oh, we have to relearn like this song, or like arrange it for the fact that there were seven Spinto band members at, or yeah, what was it, seven, more like six. There are a lot of us. We had four guitars on stage, like, yeah. It was just like, yeah, we did a lot of like instrument changes, because like, oh well Jeff knows the drum part on this song, but like I did the drum part on the recording. So like a lot of switching off and two drummers at one point. It was just like kind of madness.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny like that. I think it's sort of like Tom was saying, it was sort of just like having to put together a set from all these weird little like studio recordings that you made that like Tom said, they weren't, a lot of them weren't necessarily written in like a tradition, like I'm writing this song and then like I'm having a band play it and we'll record it. It was just very much like overdubbed, like one at a time, each instrument. And so, yeah, having to relearn stuff. And then it's like, oh, like who played this on this song? Like, oh, do you still remember it? Like, yeah. Okay. And then you play that one then. And then sort of like Yeah, and we sort of just stitched together like a normal rock and roll set from our favorite tunes from those demo tapes, you know. Yeah, I remember the first show was like just a local battle of the bands. It was pretty fun. I remember we got second. We've always placed second in every battle of the bands we've ever done. And it was it was pretty funny though. Pretty fun show.
Yeah. So how did things progress for you guys then from those early days doing these recordings with Free Beer and under Spinter Tonic and then getting giggy and then, you know, sort of rebranding as the Spinto Band and putting out that debut album Nice and Nicely Done on Bar None Records in 2005. How did that journey sort of come about?
Yeah. Yeah, well, so it sort of starts with one of the band members, John Eaton. His uncle was Robin Eaton, and his uncle owned a studio in Nashville. So, like, you know, through the grapevine, our songs had gotten to his uncle, and he was like, oh, you guys should come down and record some tracks. So we ended up, and that studio, Alex the Great Recording, is where we ended up doing all the tracks that would end up being Nice and Nicely Done. So that was sort of like, all those tunes from that record, they had their origins in the basement, and like we had done basement versions, kind of like how Tom and I were just describing. And then it was sort of like going to like the real studio to do like real versions, you know? So that would have been like, like early 2000s, I guess, starting to do that, going down there on like summer vacations and school holidays, record a couple songs at a time to do, kind of like picking our favorites from the demo tapes and then sort of going there to kind of like flesh them out and make them into real songs, I guess. Some of them were like really short too, you know, like sometimes there'd be a song and it'd just be like a verse and a chorus and that's it. It's like, oh yeah, that's the song. And then it was sort of like, well, let's try and make this like as long as a regular song. And then, you know, I think, you know, Robin, John's uncle Robin, is a songwriter too, and he definitely was like trying to encourage us to think about, you know, songwriting in that sense, like, you know, try a pre-chorus or a bridge once in a while, see what that feels like. So that was sort of that Nice and Nicely Done record was kind of just recorded there over a series of, you know, summer vacations. I don't know, Tom, do you have any other memories of that process?
Yeah.
Sort of going from the Jam Monkey to the Alex the Great.
Yeah, that was like, you put it pretty aptly. It was just like, it wasn't like one long recording session. It was like a bunch of different ones over, you know, a lot of us were still in high school at the time when we were recording it, just in summer vacations that we had, you know, it could be 1 week at a time, could be like 3 weeks at a time. It kind of came together like piecemeal. And that was definitely like a real studio, like from our basement studio. And I think one of my first memories was just like, man, we have to like play the song, like, you know, doing different takes of a song was like a new concept to us, of just because it was usually just like, okay, there it is, it's done. And they were like, oh, you want us to play as like how long, like how many times do we have to play the song? And like get sore after a while. But that was a very educational experience as well, because that was like kind of the proper way of doing things. And I remember trying to incorporate like the sounds that we were getting at our basement studio like into like the proper recording studio. I think it ended up being a nice balance.
So I feel like we had sort of like, there was initial, like, yeah, so we went over there, you know, I think it was sort of probably like a 4 year span. And then we kind of, like I said, every little summer we'd record a bunch. And then I remember at the end, there was a little bit of sort of like head butting between like what maybe like the band wanted to sound like and what sort of some of the recording engineer producers wanted to like make. And then we did sort of like the following year, we kind of did like a truce, and we're like, it's like, okay, we're just gonna record like eight songs in a stretch. And that ended up being like the bulk of Nice and Nicely Done. And then we kind of handpicked our favorites from the previous sessions to fill it out.
That's interesting in itself, isn't it? That's interesting in itself, Nick, because quite often albums are sort of like a snapshot of where a band are at a time. But if this is a process that's gone over a few years, then I guess as you know, musicians or as people just generally, you're evolving quite a lot during that time, and perhaps even how you want the band to sound. So it's quite interesting, I guess, that you at the end of it, you have a mix of, as you say, about 8 songs which have been recorded there and then, but then some others that have been sort of brought in from previous sessions, or elements of different songs that have been brought in from sort of previous sessions from years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I feel like that's sort of a, I feel like you kind of hear that a lot though with bands, especially new bands, like, you know, their first album might have songs that they've written like years in advance. Like I know like some of the songs from Nice and Nicely Done were written probably like when I was 15 or 16, you know, and then they wouldn't, even though they were, even if they were maybe recorded in that big stretch, they were still like old songs. But yeah, you're right. There was definitely like a, you know, like a growth and like evolving during that time. And I feel like that little tension, the sonic tension between maybe like where we saw ourselves as an indie band and where some people saw, wanted to like make it real slick. Like that was definitely like a learning experience, where we sort of, you know, played around in a couple of different sandboxes until we found one we were really comfortable in.
Director Helmet was one I always liked, but I think it's fair to say Oh Mandy was sort of the breakout one, or the breakthrough track over here for you guys. That just seemed to be the one that people would always play if they were talking about this Vinto band. So can you just tell us a little bit about how that one came together, how Oh Mandy came together?
Yeah, sure. That was written in around 2003. And so that was, it came together super fast. Actually, I wrote that tune and it came together really quick. It's weird when I think back on that song, it's maybe one of like the quickest songs I've ever written, which is kind of weird to think about. Like the one that connected with most people was the one that was just like a spewed out super fast. I feel like there's something to that. I wish I could harness more often, or like tell myself it's cool more often. But so I came together. I wrote it on a mandolin, which is always, like Tom was saying, like a new instrument inspires a new song. And that sort of like came about through just like having this mandolin and just trying to figure out a tune to it. And then I did a demo of that at my house. And then that one we kind of built up with the live band from that demo. And it's kind of like transferred the parts and recorded it, that one in Nashville with the guys.
Cool. And do you remember sort of the initial reception that track got and the album, of course, when it came out? Do you remember, as we discussed, you very much, you know, fairly in your own little bubble initially with your recordings, and suddenly to now have, you know, quite, you know, widespread success and recognition for your album and that single in particular, what was your feelings at that time? How did you respond to such a big change?
My recollection of that is always tied to sort of like, for whatever reason, like blog, like music blog culture and MySpace. Like it just kind of feels like in that weird like right place, right time thing where I guess people were listening to Oh Mandy and that like got, you know, people were sharing it and like writing about it from, you know, far away places for us. Like in the UK, we were like, oh, this, people are like excited about this like song we did. That's wild. So that's kind of like my first reactions were just like, just the fact that it was like going places through the internet, which was always, we were always like on the internet, like as like kids, like on like, but like, I don't know, this, it was like a new phase of the internet at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely felt pretty wild, but then at the same time, like, I feel like as a young 20 something, you've got this like sense of that you're just the coolest thing on the planet. And like, I remember at the time, you know, the early, super early 2000s, like the Philadelphia music scene, which we kind of like gravitated to as like our closest big city. There's just like so many great bands. And then we were all like buddies and we're all playing. And and then like bands would start like, it's like a something spinning around, and like bands would like spin off and like, wow, like bam bam, like bands are starting to get cool, like Dr. Dog is starting to get known, and like all these bands, like the Teeth starting to get known, like they're touring, oh my gosh, they're doing a tour to the Midwest. And then it was sort of like we spun off and started getting recognized over in the UK, and in a way it was just like, well, yeah, we're these awesome bands. Like, of course, I'm not surprised that like someone in the UK is digging this. Like, Philadelphia's got the coolest music on the planet. Come on, come on over to the party. So there's like a little bit of that sort of, I feel like in hindsight, I can recognize that just be in myself, just being like, yeah, this is what happens to bands that we think are cool. Yeah. But like, you know, now looking back now, it's like definitely kind of blows my mind that it connected so much.
And what are your memories then of rocking up over here and playing to UK crowds and touring around this country?
Oh man, I feel like I have so many cool memories of that. Like there was that, you know, I feel like from the fall of 2005 through all of 2006 is just so much time over there playing. Like the Windmill was our first show. I remember that was pretty wild.
In Brixton, that one.
Yeah, Brixton, yeah, Windmill. Yeah. It was just like, and then staying at the Columbia, which is that sort of like legendary, like rotten rock and roll hotel. It's just, but it was just like magic to us, you know. Yeah, and then shoot, I mean, like 2006 really kind of like took off. I feel like we spent more time over there than we did over here. But then, of course, we like opened up for the Arctic Monkeys over here for their first U.S. tour, which was like, that was a pretty huge thing, obviously. And yeah, I mean, I don't know, Tom, you go ahead. I'm just blabbering here.
I would do the same blabbering. It's like, it's still, I mean, it never got old. Just the fact that like, you know, you fly, you know, I had visited the UK as like a kid on a family vacation, but then just to go over there for actual, like, oh, like people are coming here to like, listen to our music. That's so, it's like, it was really hard to get a grip of. And just the fact that, you know, we played shows in the US and booked our own tours, you know, sometimes playing shows in Ohio to like five people, and that, you know, and to come over to the UK and the rest of Europe to just like these big crowds was just, it's just a wonderful feeling.
Yeah.
So, which makes sense. We're spending so much time over there.
And it was such a cool like scene too. It felt like, I don't know, like it's cool music. I remember I went to, so actually like when I graduated college, which was like early 2005, I went to London as like that was like my graduation present, was I got to go to London on a vacation. And I remember going and just like, you know, where I was staying, but I would just go to like shows every night and just see what was going on. My biggest memory is, I feel like it was like a club night, maybe called the Birthday Party. It was in like the Soho club or something.
Yeah.
And it was VHS or Beta and the Shout Out Louds.
Yeah.
I just remember standing like, you know, so this was like some spring, summer 2005. It was like this tiny little venue, but it's like the coolest feeling. And it always blows my mind. I remember like, so then the following year at that time, like summer 2006, we were just like, that was when we were just going nuts over there. I was like blowing my mind. I was like, holy cow, like a year ago I was seeing, and then like, we were like playing a festival and like hanging out with the Shout Out Lads and like Stockholm as like the sun isn't even setting. And I realized it's like 6 a.m. and the sun hadn't set, you know, it's like, it's crazy. Kind of have to pinch yourself moment. You know,
yeah,
amazing.
I just wanted to know more about this Arctic Monkeys tour in the States. It sounds like good fun to me. What, how did they go down?
Oh yeah, I mean, they went down like they were just like a phenomenon at that point, you know. It was like that first record, their first time ever in the US. It was just, I don't know, they were just riding a wave that couldn't even comprehend. but they're cool dudes.
Yeah, was it you got on with them while you were on tour with them?
Yeah, we were friendly. I mean, I feel like I never really kept up with them, which is like, I wish I had kept up, but it was weird, you know. It's sort of a strange time in a way. It's sort of like some bands you click with right away and you become like super close, and then others it's like you're friendly but you don't really have a big bond. And I don't know, it seemed like we both of us, our bands were also sort of like in a little bubble at the time, so we didn't quite like cross-pollinate too much. I remember a couple good dice games though. that were really fun.
Cool, good stuff, guys. Well, we'll get more of the Spinto band story in part two of the podcast, so stick with us.
Hey everybody, this is Nick.
And this is Thomas from the Spinto Band, and you're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast.
We made USAA insurance to help you save. Take advantage of discounts when you cover your home and your ride. Discover how we're helping members save at usaa.com/bundle. USAA. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this.
Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we're with Nick and Thomas from the Spinto Band. You've followed up that debut album with your second album, Moonwink, 3 years later. So how did that change then? How did that evolve? We've heard about the songs like Oh Mandy blowing up over here in the UK, and you coming over here and touring a lot over here. So I guess you're in a slightly different place by the time you go to lay down that second album.
Oh, yeah, definitely in a different place. I think what strikes me most about like that second record is that, you know, we had been playing these Nice and Nicely Done songs as a live band, like playing shows like in the US, like going on tours for like, it felt like, you know, probably between like 2.5-3 years, just like playing these songs. And we were just like a super, like as a band, we were super tight. And then in the writing and in like preparing for Moonwink, I felt like we were just like, okay, well, we're recording this, you know, we're playing these songs live, we're arranging them live, we're like doing everything in this current formation as a band, as opposed to Nice and Nicely Done, which was like kind of recorded in pieces and, you know, written in pieces. Even though like we arranged it as band for the most part, it was just like, it definitely felt like we were, this is the band, you know, the band recording and arranging the songs for that record. And we recorded in one bulk session too, which was different than Nice and Nicely Done in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very much, my biggest memory of like that, those sessions was like, well, especially writing the record, like Tom said, we were like in this band mode. So we prepared for that record in the rehearsal space. You know, we just go in every day with these songs and really kind of like zone in on all of the different parts. And I don't know, there was almost like a goal at that time, or maybe I look back as like doing weird, really super like involved arrangements that sort of like intertwine and puzzle piece together. So like a lot of that band practice is like trying to dial those things in, and like, I don't know, in hindsight, it maybe just makes that record really hard to listen to. but that was sort of like, I feel like that was sort of one of the games, like the fun games we were playing with ourselves. And I remember, you know, I guess the only thing I can hang my hat on is I remember when we were mixing it, the mixer, the super cool mixer, Chad Blake was mixing it. And he was like, you know, there's so much going on here. A lot of times I'll try and mute stuff to see if it sounds better, but it never does. It always sounds worse until I put it back in, and then it like clicks. So, you know, I guess we sort of won our little game we were playing there.
Yeah. I was listening to it on my run this morning, and it was just, it felt like it got a lot of energy in it. I think that was my lasting impression with it. It was sort of, yeah, just coming at me. It was sort of, yeah, it was good. Well, good running music anyway, I thought.
Nice. That's good. Yeah. I feel like I remember that, like that is like a very up-tempo record. It's like,
yeah,
is there any downtime in that record? Like, I don't think so. Maybe like that, oh man, I forget even the track list right now. But the one that starts with the trumpets, Tom, your tune.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm even forgetting the name of that song. they
all laughed.
Yeah. That's like the only down tempo. And that is so funny. Yeah, we were just like ramping it up. The BPMs were just going to 160. We were really challenging our drummer Jeff, just like putting him.
Yeah, totally.
On that one.
And maybe that speaks to the live thing, like just coming off a year of just playing live so much, and we're just like amped up, you know, and didn't have the wherewithal to tell ourselves like, yo, pump the brakes, dude.
Yeah.
Make another ballad or something.
Yeah.
How did that then compare to the third record, Shy Pursuit, 2012 that came out? I think you had working in your own studio by that point. You know, was there a different feeling within the band at that point? And yeah, when you do set out on these records, did you talk about having that kind of up tempo feeling that just kind of seemed to come naturally for after playing live for so long? But did you, when you started approaching maybe a third or fourth record, did you go into the studio with, you know, something in mind that you wanted to try and achieve, or was it just going back to, you know, your roots of your normal writing and recording process?
I feel like that Shy Pursuit was almost like we wanted to kind of so real quick back to Moonwink. So like we had written that record like in the rehearsal space, and in a sense like that record was almost the more traditional band record, where it's like we wrote these songs and then we worked them up as a band, and then we went to a studio for 5 weeks. Shout out to Dave Trumfio, who engineered that record, in his studio in Los Angeles. And like, we recorded it in sort of like a traditional album making kind of way. And then, so by the time we were wanting to work on Shy Pursuit, I feel like there was this sense of wanting to kind of like, we missed that initial basement recording feel, where it was just very much a game and like a very casual experience, you know? And like, I don't know. Definitely casual in the basement, but we weren't necessarily casual about the recording of Shy Pursuit, but there was just like a different feeling where it wasn't that sort of like pressure cooker of writing and rehearsing, pressure cooker of studio time. We wanted to kind of get back to that more like handing off instruments, like, hey, if someone have an idea, let's experiment. Like, just be a little more freer with our approach to that Shy Pursuit one. So yeah, that kind of coincided with us setting up our little headquarters where we built our own studio to make that record.
Yeah, I think there was much more room to experiment with sounds. The leisure of just like it was a really great experience of just, okay, everyone put all your instruments in this one space. And you know, there we had so many keyboards. We were going on Craigslist and hunting down like weird instruments, and they were all in this one space. And that was like kind of like the go-between between like the professional recording environment. And you know, at that time, like Nick had like had a lot of great recording gear, and you know, really good ear for and like talent for mixing and production. And so he was handling a lot of that, but we at the same time we had the freedom to, you know, let's spend like a whole day like playing around on a marimba or like an organ, trying to like get this part like to be perfect, which is like has its pros and cons, but it was a nice change from the Moonwink recording, where it was just like these are the songs, these are how we're going to do them, and we have 5 weeks to do them. That was the big difference between those two for me.
So where did Cool Cocoon fall? Was that an intense one, or was that another one where you were able to sort of take a bit more time over?
Well, yeah, I feel like Cool Cocoon in a sense is like the answer to Shy Pursuit's sort of long experimentation. Cool Cocoon was written and recording super fast, but done in that same, our own studio. So I'm trying to remember the timeline. It was like, I'm pretty sure we started that record and released it within like 9 months, which I remember, I was just like, I'm always in a big Beatles nut. And then I was just wrapping my head around just like, gosh, these guys were on like this incredible, like bands, any band back then, like not even just the Beatles, but just like any band back then was just releasing two albums a year and like singles in between, and then like having just spent quite a long time recording Shy at Pursuit was sort of like, man, why we got to get, I got to like, you know, tighten this up and like quit, you know, take what we learned from the experimentation and then try and mix in some, like take what we've learned from the experimentation and that gained experience and then inject some spontaneity and like, you know, gut reactions to it. And I think that's sort of, I guess that was at least sort of in my head for Cool Cocoon as a sort of an approach to it. Yeah.
So I guess you get an appreciation there of how hard it must have been for the Beatles just keep turning out album after album, year after year. It's ridiculous, wasn't it, really?
It's crazy. Yeah, yeah. It's bonkers. I mean, those guys are crazy. It's just amazing. I'm like a huge Beatles nut, and I've been doing, so like this whole past decade, I was playing this game called The Beatles in Real Time, which I only listened to a Beatles record if it officially came out 50 years ago. So I started back in 2013. And I just like started with Please Please Me, and I wouldn't. So like I didn't listen to Abbey Road until it came out last year. I didn't listen. Don't listen to like Let It Be till it comes out, you know, 50 year anniversary. And it was cool to like experience that timeline. And man, nice. Such a, I mean, they're a magic band. We all know that. We don't need a new podcast talking how good Beatles are. But they are awesome. And then the having Jeff Emerick and George Martin and like, it's like the perfect tinderbox of like insanely talented people feeding off each other, put in a facility with other insanely talented people who could like realize everyone's vision. It's like, I don't know. It's pretty magical.
Yeah. I like that game. I might have to take that one up for the 60 years.
It's fun, man.
When 2023 comes around, I'll do the same thing.
Yeah. You should do it with your favorite band. It doesn't have to be the Beatles. True. Just like, it's a pretty cool experience. Just like, no matter what band you choose, just to like kind of like relive the timeline, especially for a band that you didn't grow up with, which, you know, you don't really have the context for. You just feel like this band came out of a vacuum into your life, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think if you don't do something like that and really dive into the albums, I think you can end up falling into the trap of just listening to, you know, the big hits, which are sort of always played over and over, or you're really familiar with, and just assuming, well, not assuming, but that's all you ever get from it. Whereas I think it, especially, I mean, obviously the Beatles was amazing, but if you sort of really dive into their catalogues, there's so many sort of treasures in there which people don't even have time to talk about because they're focused on the big ones.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, especially their early stuff, you know, like everything like Revolver On or Rubber Soul On is like, you know, it's like that's iconic stuff that everybody knows about and you hear played all over the time. But like all the, like, there's the song on Please Please Me called There's a Place, which is just blows my mind. Like I never spent much time with it. And it's like the best song ever. It's under 2 minutes long. It, like you go on this amazing journey. It sounds great. But yeah, it's funny. I also like, it's funny too, because I feel like my like sonic personality is like, I can get sustenance from a single song for like years. It's weird. Like I'm not necessarily the kind of guy who is just like, I'll take an album and I'll like dissect an album. It's like, if I'm like obsessed with a song, like I can get musical sustenance from that for ages. So it was like, it was also a good, you know, a good, good thing to do, like a good challenge personally to my musical self to just like, you know, do this sort of like record based thing.
Nice. Obviously Cool Cocoon was the last Spinto band album. So, you know, obviously you can hear your passion for music now, and obviously you can see that in producing others and Tom as well. Is there any sort of ambition to record again together, to create new music together yourselves rather than with other people?
Ah, man, I don't know. It's tough to say. Everyone's in just new, different phases of life. I mean, I wouldn't count it out. That's for sure. But, you know, I think we just need to figure out how to go about it. I don't know, Tom, what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think when I look back at like Spinto Band, I'm just constantly amazed at like, just like when I try to like schedule things in life now, it's like, yeah, we're scheduling like six different people. And like, it was like, it all worked out somehow. And like, yeah. But yeah, that'd be fun. And we got together and got to play some live shows for the anniversary of Nice and Nicely Done. I guess that wasn't too, I guess that was kind of long ago at this point, but yeah, it's but for new recordings, like, yeah, I wouldn't count it out. But yeah.
Be good. So there's no major falling out, no John and Yoko situation here.
nah, we're all buddies still.
Good. And so let's talk a little bit about your time since then, guys. So I know Nick, you've done some work with Clap Your Hands Say Yeah and touring with them. We had Alec on the podcast a few months back. Yeah, really good band that we were into in a similar way back in the day. So how did you come to work with Alec, and what are your memories of that time working with Clap Your Hands?
Yeah, I met Alec. Well, Alec is another Philadelphia guy, so I sort of had met him through just through musical friends. When he did a record called a Flashy Python record, his backing band were these musicians from this other band that had recently split up called The Teeth, which was just like this super, one of my favorite Philadelphia bands of all time. And they had just split up, and then three of members from that band became his backing band for that tour. And so I was buddies with The Teeth, and so I had met Alec through them. And then, yeah, I guess come around like 2014 or so, when Spinto Band activity started to die down, he was looking for someone to come in to play, do like keyboards and guitar with Clap Your Hands. So yeah, there'd been some like member turnover in their band. So I joined up with him and ended up playing live with him for a few years and co-produced a record with him, The Tourist, which came out like 2016, I think that was released, or 2017, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was cool. It was a great time. He's a super talented songwriter. It was a really fun group of people to play with too. It's really fun, like being in a band like that, where like, I mean, Spindle Band was like that too, but like, I feel like at that time there was a lot of bands like playing with tracks, and like I was even in this side project where we'd like play to synchronize tracks and stuff. But then like a band like Clap Your Hands Say Yeah, where everybody's like foot is on the gas pedal at the same time, it's just super fun live environment to play in.
Yeah, I really remember chatting to him, because it was a really sort of one that still stands out now, sort of how they sort of blew up. And I remember he was sort of just sort of packaging and mailing out records from, I think, his mum's flat or something like that. It was right. They couldn't meet the demand, really. I think we talked earlier, didn't we, about MySpace and how that sort of could just propel bands into a whole new level of sort of fame recognition. And I think that's certainly what happened to them.
He got it like orders of magnitude more than us. I was going to say, like, he experienced like what Tom was describing, but just like orders of magnitude more intense. It was like, you know, that was a wild wave to ride for him, for sure.
Yeah
definitely. Tom, we didn't mention earlier about sort of some of the music videos for Spinto Band, because they're pretty quirky, some of them. And I know you've got onto sort of this project, Carol Cleveland Sings. Can you tell us a bit more about this? Because this is a bit of a mix of those two things, isn't it?
Carol Cleveland Sings is like just like what I would call stuff like before it became like a Spinto Band song. Inevitably. just like I don't know, whatever. And so it sort of started off as a music project, but then my wife and I, Gretchen, we started doing these music videos to kind of just like pass the time, and put them on Instagram and stuff, and Vine at the time. Which you mentioned, like the Spinto Band videos, that's like a big part of that aesthetic is our brother Albert Burney, who was in Spinto Band for a while, and then sort of he's sort of designed a lot of our single artwork and did a lot of our music videos. And so that visual aesthetic has always been sort of like part of like a lot of Albert Burney in that.
Nice. Yeah, really cool. Guys, it's been really good fun chatting to you guys about this Spinto Band story. We've got three more questions for you in our encore before we let you go, though. And the first one, Nick, maybe Tom, you can pile in here as well. We were going to ask you, Nick, what would be your dream band to produce?
Oh, my gosh. So is it like Living or Dead of all time?
Yeah, you can take it or, and or run like with it, really.
Band? Oh my gosh. Tom, you need to ask Tom a question because I got to think about this one. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's bad. Like going back to my thing about like I wrote Omandi in like 15 minutes. Like I should just say the first band.
Yeah. Instinct reaction.
I don't know. Yeah, I feel like, I mean, obviously the first band that came into my mind was the Beatles, but I know I would screw them up. Like, I was like, you can't put me in that. I would just mess them up. But like, I don't know. Gosh, darn. That's a really tough one. I'm such a Beatles fan. Like, even like being in the same room with Paul would be mind-blowing. I just feel like he's such a musical dude. It'd be fun to, I mean, that's, you know, take a moonshot, you know, let's go for it.
There you go. Yeah. Put it out there. See if he's listening.
Yeah. Sure. He's got another album on the horizon.
Yeah. I'm here if you need me, Paul.
I like to imagine Nick, you being like, but like the experienced George Martin at the time and like the Beatles coming in, like not having recorded anything yet. How would that like interaction be?
Oh my gosh. I don't know.
They're 20 somethings. Like,
yeah, gosh darn. It's I can't even think about it. I feel like maybe I could just play like I could be on like I don't know some weird I could just take part in the weird like sound collage on the White Album or something. I just like help them rewind the tapes. That's probably the extent of I could be qualified. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I don't know. It's a really good question.
I was watching the film yesterday, the day before yesterday.
Oh, probably. Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Where
he wakes up and everyone else has forgotten about the Beatles and he's got to try and sort of rewrite all the songs. And that's quite funny, sort of seeing them in the studio, sort of trying to remember the lyrics or how does this one go? And I did think that would be an interesting challenge. So how many songs could you remember and how they go if you had no sort of resource?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Eleanor Rigby's the one in the film, isn't it? He struggles the lyrics to Eleanor Rigby. They're so weird and wonderful. So
yeah.
All right, guys. Next up in our encore is for you to pick out the best gig that the Spinto band ever did.
I have one that the first one that came to my mind for sure was, and it's a weird one because it's just like it was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Like back, this is like even before Nice and Nicely Done, but we had done this little, we had this friend out in Madison and he was like, yeah, if you come out to Madison, we can like book a whole Midwest tour for you or something. You're like, yeah, let's do it. That's awesome. This is probably like 2003 or four, maybe, I don't know. And then of course, like we were only able to book one show in Toledo on the way out there, I think. And like, we showed up to that show and like the guy's like, what are you talking about? Bands, there's no bands at this club. It's like, oh man. but the greatest show was in Eau Claire, just because it was just like, I just remember that feeling. It was like the first time ever playing a show and just feeling like you and the audience were just like in it together, you know, and like just the energy was just pushing off and on, and it was just like, I don't know, you know, like it's a thrill. I don't know if either of you musicians at all.
No, we're both big fans. So yeah, we're on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, you know it from like the fan perspective when you're at a show and it's just like you are giving it to the band and they're just giving it right back and it's just like the sum is greater than any of its parts. And I don't know. I just remember that being that Eau Claire show, it's feeling that energy for the very first time. It's like, holy cow, this is incredible.
Yeah. Magical.
So I'll put that up there pretty high on my list.
How about you, Thomas? Is there another one? To your minds?
I always return to like there's a show we played in Glasgow, Scotland that was just like, I don't know, something about it just felt like everyone, it was just like this jovial party and this like, you know, sold out show and everyone there just like I wanted to be friends with and getting to talk with people and just I don't know, just like it's just a solid memory. Even though it's a little bit hazy, it's just like I remember having a grand old time.
Yeah, always get a good energy up in Glasgow, big time.
Final question of the podcast, guys. It's the hardest one. What's the song you're proudest of?
Oh my gosh. Oh man. Well, the first thing that just came to my mind, I'll follow the gut instinct thing. I wrote this little lullaby a few months back And that's my my current.
So I was listening to this on your Instagram page the other day.
There it is. It's on there. So I feel like, I feel like pretty proud of that. Just came from a nice space, came out quick, and that's the first one that came to my mind. So that's what I'll say.
beautiful little lullaby. I loved it.
Jeez, I don't know. I'm just thinking of Spinnow Band stuff. I think my favorite Spinnow Band record is the last one we did, Cool Cocoon, and the song on there, Amy and Jen. I just feel like this worked out pretty well, I guess. And it was just like, yeah. So I'll say that one.
Cool, fine choice. Thomas, Nick, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thanks very much for your time. It's been great to get the lowdown on the Spinto Band story. We had people getting in touch with us wanting to hear your story. And I remember back then, actually, I remember thinking you were an English band because you were so much part of the scene. So it's it's great to get to the bottom of where you're really from and get the full.
Well, it's an honor to be. It was so fun back then, man. Just being part of, it did really feel like being part of that community. Like I remember when we were on tour with the Mystery Jets, that was like the height for me. Is like that whole crew, and you know, I don't know, just being part of that little scene for what. Little interlopers into that scene. I can only imagine what it must have been if you're actually from there and feeling like real pride from all this music coming out of yours.
Yeah, nice special world. Time. And you're a big part of it for a lot of fans over here. So thanks very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.